Kareem and I are going to give this together, and we have a question for you. Okay. So we have like an hour and a quarter, I think, and we can either do each of us the 15-minute versions of what we do, and then we can have the rest of the discussion, or we can do the 25-minute versions each and have 25 minutes of discussion. So which would you rather? I mean, I don't know whether you already know all this stuff and you just want to chat, or whether you'd like sort of the framing. So how many of you would like 25, 25, 25? How many of you like 15 from each of us and then 40, what would it be, 45 collectively?
Option to revise and extend. So if it's going really well, we can just keep going.
I suppose. So, okay, so let's just launch very quickly then. You will see me skipping over slides. Okay, so the first slide, there it is. Second slide, I want to just say that a lot of people are doing research in this, and so Kareem and I are reporting stuff that's really fun and exciting, and other people are to be credited as well. So, the underlying thought was, you know, where do innovations come from? They really historically have been argued to have come from the manufacturers. That basically manufacturers, since Schumpeter, look at the center of the market and they say, whoa, look at all those users. Manufacturers can aggregate their demand and then they can innovate, and the result will be that they can do a better job than can any individual user innovating for his or herself. The missing piece was that in fact, at the leading edge, the market is by definition small. And so in fact, what you get when you track back to the beginnings of things, what you get is this kind of pattern. So this is a guy who developed the heart-lung machine, and his name is John Haysham Gibbon, and a patient died on his operating table that he thought he could have saved if he'd been able to stop the heart momentarily. He went to manufacturers and said, hey, we need a heart-lung machine, and they said, yeah, have you developed the operations to go with it? Well, no, but I know I can. Well, do you think anybody else will want it? Yes. Do you know that? No. So immediately market manufacturers say, well, if the need is small and uncertain, we want nothing to do with it. So this poor guy, in effect, had to spend 20 years developing this thing for himself. So this is what happens. In fact, what we then did was we studied it in a range of areas to actually quantify the number of innovations users had developed versus manufacturers. This particular one is in the area of scientific instruments. We did it in a lot of other areas as well. Took the sample of the most important innovations, tracked back the innovations on each of these to find out where they really came from, and ended up discovering that in fact, most of the important innovations, and I'll qualify that in a minute as the functionally novel important innovations, were actually developed by users, not by manufacturers. Okay, so the other curious thing we discovered is that manufacturers did not know this. So the fascinating situation was that it took a lag of like 5 to 7 years between what the user would develop and the first manufacturer. Now, part of the reason for this is that what users do is they make things for themselves, and these things that they make for themselves are kludges. You know, you just make them so they work. And so a manufacturer comes along and he looks at that. This is the first automated radioimmunoassay system developed by doctors who had to do 20,000 patients for a study, and manual methods just wouldn't hack it. You couldn't even get your students to do it 20,000 times. Anyway, so the manufacturer looks at that and says, hell, that's not a product. There's no room for our logo. There's no operator's manual. What kind of a piece of junk is this? And they come up with this, which is the same thing. But in fact, obviously, it's much glitzier and better and more reliable and stable. So the manufacturers do stuff, but the point is that inside this is this. So now, this is true wherever you look, agricultural innovations done by users. This is center pivot irrigation. And what you see here is that's the first one, put together from what the farmer had around. What you see here is this old irrigation pipe, wheels from tractors, and so on and so forth. And he built it, and it worked, and it's a major agricultural innovation. Here's the glitzy manufacturer version, and what you see is much cleaner, right? Much neater. But the key is that people didn't understand where the innovations came from. For example, I called up these people and I said, so, did you get input from users living or dead? And they said, certainly not. Be sure to send us a plaque with our name spelled right. So, the key issue here then is not that that life, you know, that, that that people take credit where they shouldn't, because in fact that's one of the things that makes life very pleasant, isn't it? The key issue is that if you don't understand where the innovations come from, you don't know how to replicate the pattern. This is also true in consumer goods, you know, everything from all sports equipment and so on done by users. Now, the key here is that we're not talking about individual users versus companies. We are talking about the relationship to the innovation of a firm or an individual. So Boeing, when it develops a machine tool to process an airplane, that's a user innovation because they expect the benefit from using it. Boeing, when they make a new airplane, that is in fact a manufacturer innovation because they expect the benefit from selling it. Okay? So that's the essential, and so it could be an individual, but it also could be a manufacturer. Now, the next thing that we find is that it is not a rare phenomenon. In fact, when you go out there and you look at user innovation, it is all over the place. And I'll show you in a moment that, in fact, it looks like this dark matter of innovation that is not measured in government statistics yet is vastly outweighing the measured stuff that you get in government statistics. It's really cool. So anyway, lots of user innovation in lots of places. These are people who care most about their innovation. So what you see here, for instance, surgical equipment, it's not all surgeons. 22% of surgeons connected with university clinics innovate. They're the ones pushing the leading edge. Same mountain biking equipment. It is 20% of the people who are in the mountain biking region. If I go to Harvard's bike racks, I won't find 20% modified. Okay, now, why do they do it? Because they have high needs. What happens now, and this is about the internet, is that the internet is enabling individual user innovators to join into collaboratives. Now, this becomes a very powerful competitor to manufacturer-based design. Okay, so now, typically what we talk about in these discussions of the internet and so on is software and things like Wikipedia. But what I want to show you is that it also applies to hardware. Okay? So this particular example is about innovation in a user innovation community in sports. Specifically, it is kite surfing. Okay, that's the board that you slide on, you can see here, and then that's the giant kite, and it sort of operates like a reverse parachute. You can go up instead of down, and you need lots of controls here because you really don't want to come down more abruptly than you hoped, right? So, it's actually quite complicated. There are five control wires and so on, all developed by users. It became a fad. Manufacturers came in. They said, this is great. They adopted the traditional strategy of saying, well, now what we do is we will innovate, okay? And we will develop, you know, our version of this and so on and so forth. So they each hired 1.5 engineers. Wasn't that big a market, so and they began to compete. Then what happened was that a guy from MIT named Saul Griffith said, well, you know, I can really post here and create a website where users can get together. Here's an example of a post. And they can exchange information. What a cool idea. So now what happened? Well, this particular posting is like a super high aspect ratio inflatable design for mountain boarding. As you know, these guys now go up mountains with their boards as well as us just along the water. And I do none of that stuff. And then what happened? What happened was that immediately a community formed and people began to bring quite sophisticated tools to that community and develop them. So what happened was, enabled by the internet, you ended up with not just 1.5 engineers with a master's degree in each company, you ended up with aerodynamicists from NASA and Boeing and places like this who were also hacking on the weekends or whatever. And they brought along, slow speed aerodynamics is a regime where you get turbulence and so on and so forth. And so they ended up with modeling tools, they ended up with design tools. They started sharing their innovations on the web. So first by sketches like this, but then by CAD. So that what you got was he got the ability to make to make a kite, encode the information, distribute it across the web. People in other countries all over the place could download these designs, cut them out on laser cutters that are used in sail lofts, and reproduce across the world. And the result was that you ended up then basically vastly in this collective activity outdoing the manufacturers. And so manufacturers began to adopt the kites from the users. So what you got is this interesting situation where we think manufacturers, this is Carlos Baldwin and I now, think that manufacturers are going to be driven out of product design in most areas by users because of the power of the internet. Specifically, what's going on here, and the two advantages that the situation enables is, number one, what you've got here, if this is a design space, let's say for all possible kites, what you've got is more users, all those X's there are experiments and activities, you've got more users than you have manufacturers. The result is they can explore more of the space. Critically, because they are users, they will share their innovations. Critically, I'm not saying as a manufacturer I might, but as a user I don't. I say, I invented a new cup holder, assuming there are cup holders on types of equipment. I invented new cup holders and you can't use it. Whereas the manufacturers are doing that. The manufacturers are saying, look, I've got an area here and I'm protecting it and you can't come in. So not only can they cover less of the area, but they wall off pieces. The result you all experience when you buy a car, you want the engine from this car and you want the back door from that car, but you can't get it. The power of the fact that it is user innovation that is open and that is widely distributed on the web is that the best solution can be adopted by anybody. And that is why, in fact, it's starting to drive things out. Now, there's a lot more to it, like modularity and the rest. But the key thing now is that we are beginning to say, okay, let's study this in more detail. And I'm going to then, Kareem is doing the collaborative innovation and how it works, and he's going to talk about that. Another thing we're doing is we're showing that, in fact, when you really do government statistics differently, it's so cool. It turns out that there's a hell of a lot more user innovation than there is manufacturing. Now, this comes from Fred Gault in Canada, and it's so cool. What they used to do, governments, because of the focus on IP and on manufacturing innovation, governments were asking manufacturers, well, did you innovate? And they said, yeah. And said, well, did you get any useful information from anybody? You know, customers help. So what did customers do? They never asked that. It could be that the customers actually designed the thing, or it could be the customers said, right on, do more. Okay. So what this thing did, and now what we're doing again in 2007, what this thing did is so cool. What it did was it said, I'm going to ask the users, in this case of advanced process equipment, how they got their equipment. And the answer turned out to be that 46% of them purchased, 26% bought and then modified, and 28% built their own. Now, if there's more than four customers per manufacturer, this means that, and of course there's maybe 400, so this means that the amount of innovation distributed around is actually being, is actually much larger than the innovation the government's counting. And now another stuff we recently did was finding that in fact this innovation is not only in the manufacturers, but they're not counting it typically as R&D. They're sort of doing it as slack or something like that. So we're going to make all that visible. Now, so what's the implication of this? In the old days when we thought that basically manufacturers were the innovators, we needed strong IP and strong brands and so on, economies of scale and the rest of it. And now, with user innovation collaboratives, you need protection for intellectual commons, low networking collaboration costs, and so on. And so that is all I think I want to say. And then I'm going to just tell you one more thing, which is so cool. So the other thing we're doing here is we're looking at the power that manufacturers still have. And one of the powers they still have is brands. Okay? Well, you know, it's, you can make your own candy bar, but a Butterfinger bar by Nestle is far better. And so, but what we're doing, the guy named Johann Fuller and I, it's so cool, is looking to see that user communities also develop brands. But they don't do it in a costly way. They're not there being forced by a manufacturer to think you're part of the Pepsi generation. That costs money to convince you you're part of the Pepsi generation. They're doing an activity on their own. And the activity on their own, they are now making badges for themselves that they put right over the manufacturer's logo on their backpacks and stuff like this. So it's very, very cool. So, Kareem.
Okay. So I'm gonna take from basically this slide that Eric has on sort of what we see is that innovation is becoming more and more collaborative, and discuss sort of the patterns of these collaborations. And in fact, what we see is that it's not individual innovators at all, but sort of collectives working together. And I'm going to sort of walk you through some examples, both in open source and a strange programming contest, where we get to see how these collaborations work and how these collaborations actually result in better performing products than any one individual might have done. So I'm going to just walk you through sort of a day in the life of a software feature. This comes from a project called PostgreSQL. They make a database that competes well against Oracle and Microsoft and so on. And we're just going to track one feature and its evolution. And you'll sort of see these different people and individuals come in, do work, go away, come in and do work, get a sense of sort of this collaborative mess. So this is Mario Balguni from Germany. And he posted on the email list a question about database vacuuming. So it's a big thing about how to clean up databases as they're working away. And the way it sort of starts off is like it sort of posts on the list. The list has about 900 members signed on to it. So this email goes to everybody. It says, you know, I know you're all working on the beta of the release, but I'm having some problems with vacuuming. I wish we could fix this. And he sort of gives a solution as well. Perhaps we can find a way to come up with a better vacuuming algorithm within our own database. He does that, and then basically, in the space of the same day as he posted that question, different people come back and provide some solutions to this thing. So Shadar from India comes in and sort of says, you know, I think we can have a different mechanism to solve this problem. Mario comes back to Shadar saying, oh, this is never going to work. Rod Tiet from Canada comes back and says, actually, Mario, you're mistaken, and here's how Shadar's proposal might work, and he actually gave some code that would show how this might work. Tom Lane comes in. Tom Lane is a core developer here in this community, and he's acknowledged the problem, says that's an important issue for us. He gave it a name, goes, well, we should have auto-vacuuming come through, and he came up with a solution that was going to be a server-based implementation. He says, in order for us to fix this properly, we got to go in the guts of the software, rip it all out, and redo it all over again. And Shadar comes back and sort of says, you know what, I'm going to come in and try to solve this problem. Okay. Now, none of these people had interacted before on this email list before. This was the first time where they showed up together to sort of solve the problem themselves. So here's what Shadar wrote. He goes, sounds like a nice idea. Give me about a week to do this, and I'll come back soon with that. And then 7 hours later, he sort of lists out his plan. Okay? He goes, I plan to work on this. Here's my brief idea. And then he sort of asks a bunch of questions. It's my first attempt to contribute to Postgres. Please let me know your comments. And then basically what happens is that as soon as Shadar posted that note, Tom Lane came back and sort of said, you know what, your approach is never going to work, this is going to be doomed forever, right? So if you imagine you're in a setting where the head of the group says, you're doomed, what are you doing? It might, you might not keep continuing. Rod Taylor, again, was sort of listening into the conversation. Remember, this is going to 900 people that are just sort of observing this discussion. Rod Taylor came back and sort of said, you know, Tom, your ideas are okay, but I've got a different perspective. Tom agrees with that. You sort of see that coming through. Barry Lind from Palo Alto comes in and comes up with a different solution. Mario comes back into the conversation and proposes yet another solution. So same problem, now we have four different solution approaches being proposed. Go this way, go that way, approach it this way. Tom Lane comes in again, sort of provides some more feedback to the discussion, and then Matthew O'Connor from Philadelphia comes in and also proposes an approach. So what you see again, a problem shows up, and then within the space of a day, right, this is all in the day, all these individuals start hammering away at it from different perspectives. And you wouldn't see this in any kind of a normal innovation setting, right, where I have a problem, I sort of sit there and go think about it, maybe talk to a couple of my colleagues, they might give me some feedback, but this type of a distributed feedback mechanism you wouldn't see. And then 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, Sridhar comes back and sort of said he solved the problem, right? And here's what he said, right? I've written a small daemon that can automatically vacuum PostgreSQL database. It sits on top of the Postgres stats collector. He sort of tells you what it does. He posts it on the net. Let me know for bugs and improvements. I'm sure there's people that are running some scripts. This is an attempt to provide a generic interface. What he did, though, is he actually abandoned his own his proposal and took elements from Rob, right, and Mario. Okay. So his initial approach, which was sort of lambasted by Tom, was he abandoned that. But he also didn't listen to Tom and what Tom was proposing either. He took other approaches that he could do. And his approach was basically one of writing a small daemon that was actually external to the system, right? It wasn't actually part of what Tom recommended, which is to go into the guts of the system and fix it up. Various people ask him questions about it, and then the list goes quiet on this issue. But then 2 months later, Matthew O'Connor comes in and says, I've taken Sridhar's code and improved on it. And the thing that he did, which was interesting, was that here's what he said. Several months ago, I tried to implement a special Postgres backend as an auto vacuum daemon. I failed due to my lack of experience. On September 23rd, Sridhar came in and wrote this in C++ and did the job, right? But everything that Postgres is based on runs on C. Right? So he goes, I've taken the code in C++ and I've written this in C now instead. Because Sridhar didn't care about rewriting it, right? He just solved the problem and moved on. And what he also did, which was remarkable, and this is how these communities work, is that he actually gave evidence of the performance as well in the email. He said, look, so on the x-axis is the number of transactions per second, and on the y-axis is transaction time, so you want to be at the lower side, right? As transaction times increase, as transaction numbers increase, you still want lower transaction times. And what he showed was that in green, that around the 700 transaction number time, the database collapses and the transaction time just increase significantly without his code. With his code, it sort of stays stable throughout, right? So here's a stranger in the community, hasn't contributed anything at all, taking somebody else's code, modified it, fixed it up, and then provides evidence to everybody else saying, here's why you should look at my code, and here's why my code works. And then Sridhar sort of, you know, he sort of says, hey, thanks for your work. You know, thank you for doing it. I don't have much interest in trying to make this into a C program. And then basically, when we sort of step back and analyze this one small feature, this feature was voted the most important feature in 7.4 released by users. And also, what was interesting is that this was on nobody's roadmap, right? This sort of emerged out of the ether from this community. Working away. What we see is that altogether there were 23 people who contributed to developing this feature. Four of them were core developers, but they actually didn't do any coding. They maybe gave some suggestions, and most of the suggestions were ignored, right? And 19 ad hoc, people that were sort of in the community coming in and out. And basically, there were, in the end, three people from the periphery of the community that actually wrote the code, did the testing, and improved upon it. And so this is a dynamic we see now with the internet, where users can collaborate with each other with some advice from the core group, but can be almost pretty much independent of the core group and come up with features that make a lot of sense. And what we see, so let me just show you a version of this where we can actually track performance. So this is data from MathWorks. MathWorks runs a very interesting programming contest, which is partial Wikipedia, partial open source, partial American Idol. And the way it works is that imagine if you're on Wikipedia and you made a change to a Wikipedia page. And on that change, it would tell you, you know, congratulations, you are now the person with the best change ever on this entry. Right? This is the best performing change we've ever seen. And this is how the MATLAB contest works. And the way this works is that there are some rules on participation. There's typically a problem given, which is sort of an NP-complete problem that you have to solve. There's some standings. You write code to solve this problem. You submit your code, and you get scored. You're told how good the code is. But the Wikipedia aspect of it is that you can look at these standings, and from there, examine the code that's been provided, right? And then you can change it. You can add your own things, or you can modify some things, and then resubmit it for evaluation, and then you can rise to the top, okay? So they run this contest for a week every 6 months, and here's what Nathan, who is a well-established developer in a different company, he takes a week off to participate in this contest. And he goes, this is my first MATLAB contest, it's giving me far too much enjoyment, it's one of the most addictive and compulsive things I've tried. Also, I have experienced physical trembling while making the final preparations to submit code. Is this normal? So here's what we see. The contest consists of three phases. There's a darkness phase, where you just work on your own, you submit code, and you see if your performance has improved. The lower the score, the better in this setting. Okay, there's a twilight phase, where you can send your code in, you get scored, and you can see how the people are scoring. And then a daylight phase, where you can see everybody else's code, you can take their code and remodify it as well. And in this contest, basically, there were 111 participants, and they submitted about 4,000 times. And what we see is that in the space of a week, we have basically between a 10x and 100x improvement in performance. The red line measures the leaders at any one point in time. So who had the best performing code at any given point in time? And this is sort of this dramatic improvement late at the end by Yikao. Yikao is an engineer working in the UK. But as we'll show you, all this code is a mass collaborative effort. Yikao gets the credit at the end, but he actually borrowed code from 32 other people to get here. Okay. But now what we can really see is sort of like what happens when you truly open up and when people can borrow and share easily and rapidly. So here's what we see. Basically, on average, the leader, those people on the red lines, are borrowing code from 19 other people. Okay, so it's not just de novo innovations. It is really cumulative and collective innovation coming together, right? And what we also analyzed is that 89% of the leader code is borrowed as well. Okay, so you need this huge amounts of transparency and sharing for us to get here. And what we see is that there's a rapid iteration between new code and reuse of code. So what this maps out are we're comparing each leader to the previous leader and examining how much code is deleted, how much code is conserved, and how much code is novel. So the overlap basically shows you the conserved code, right? This is the deleted code as compared to here, and this is the new code. And what you see here are that there are these punctuations where somebody comes in with a brand new stuff that makes a lot of difference, but then other people show up and make small incremental improvements, and you sort of go up the frontier of performance, right? And there's a trade-off between how much new stuff you bring in and how much old stuff is reused along the way. And what we see, again, is that once you have code that is performing well, it gets massive reuse. So this is just showing you one line of code and its evolution. So Jim McCullough had this one line, he had actually a bunch of lines of code, and the best Jim ever got to was 100 place with this line of code somewhere in the contest, right? Then somebody else took that, recognized that code as being good, right? Made it part of somebody else's code base, shows up here, as comes up at the top, and as soon as this code ends up at the top, this is this explosion in reuse by other people, right? But this recognition from here to here had to be done by somebody else who could recognize it, make sense of it, make it part of something better, and then from there improve it. So let me show you a little video which will outline the leaders, okay? And this is a snapshot of every single leader. The colors inside the box represent different authors, okay? And then the red lines are going to show you the novel code coming through. So we'll basically go through the whole contest in about a space of a minute, right? And what you see is that as these colors are changing, you can see new authors being added to the leading entry, okay? And the red represents novel code being inserted, right? So there's this big change where all this blue came in, right? And then you'll sort of see it over time shrink out and new stuff being added as well. But each color here represents different authors participating. Okay. And so this is, again, our ability to take elements from other people, recombine, remix, and put it out there. And then other people finding better ways to use your code than you might have yourself along the way. And so with that, we'll stop here and then open it up for discussion.
Very cool. Yeah. So question.
Okay. I have found that there are some things that volunteers can do and that it's fun for them to do, and other things that you really need professionals, because either volunteers don't find it fun or don't want to do it. I work for a lot of nonprofits, and that's true. I also work with computer documentation, a lot of people who get online. But I also notice that people like to muddle through. They say, well, we'll get through it, no, we'll work a little harder, and it's hard to persuade them they really have to pay for the professional. And maybe that's okay, they can train each other, but sometimes it would be good if they just break down and say, we'll hire somebody.
So, do others have comments on that, or certainly we do? Yeah, please.
I was just going to say, it was interesting that you said professionals there, because it seemed like some of what you were mentioning in your presentation is that you get a lot of professionals who contribute on a volunteer basis.
That's right. So distributed innovation, you know, if you broadcast widely, you often attract really the top folk. So we have to think about why in your case this is not so. I mean, and we can do that. Yeah.
So, you know, if I can add, I mean, so a lot of the Linux code is driver code, right? And driver code is pretty darn boring, right? Not exciting, not the leading edge of computer science. But that gets written by volunteers, too. So I think there is something about what we might define as fun to one group might be boring to another group, but that boring stuff may actually be fun to another group, or necessary, they might do it.
They want the device to work.
Yeah, so.
Well, see, that's critical, yeah, because if you are a user, you need it for yourself. Yeah. It's not just entertainment, yeah.
I just want to add that in professional groups, you very often complain about structures that prevent various forms of interaction, which could be potentially beneficial. And in some of these other groups, which are volunteer groups, you find the same things. In other words, you find patterns of interaction going on which restrict what they could possibly do. So they're getting secondary gain, or even the social nature, which prevents other forms of interaction.
Interesting. Yeah.
I'm intrigued in some of your earliest assumptions on how, you know, we could sort of industrialize them or put them into practice. If we speak of user-driven innovation and the fact that the users make sense of the things they see around them, you were showing a sort of a two-stage innovation process where somebody came up with something because you were solving a problem. It's a very open source response. Use the things you've got around you, solve it. And then somebody else took that thing and made it elegant and scalable. Right, that was the intent in some way, the physical artifacts to show. The theory we are trying to practice our RPGs, but we can take that in the world of software and systematize that. But if we can explore the tools we use in such a form that he gets a palette of things to work with, then we've actually taken out the two phase and made it one phase. Do you have research that sort of would help us understand that? Do you accept the contention?
No, see, that absolutely, this is about toolkits. And you got the 15-minute version because you wanted it, man. Guilt-induce you. And so in fact, yes, what happens now when users innovate and you see them innovating, one thing you can do is like that farmer, you as a manufacturer doing hunting and gathering. He innovated on his own. You provided him with no tools in advance, and he did what he did. Now, in many fields, one of the things that you can do is provide a toolkit that makes it easier for users to innovate. Often these toolkits have constraints, so you're innovating within a box of some sort. So it has pluses and minuses. But absolutely, the fascinating thing here, and this is all happening on our watch, is that historically, find a need and fill it has been there as a strategy. And 10,000 researchers have done work on this. And now we're sort of filling in the whole space as to how on earth distributed collaborative innovation works, like Kareem is showing you how it works, you know, and what the economics of it are. And the thing that's so exciting is that it appears economically, you know, Carlos Baldwin and I keep on writing these titles to papers like Manufacturers on the Dust Heap of History. No. Manufacturers in the ash heap of history? You're missing the point. But anyway.
He's at the business school too.
That's right. Alas. But anyway, so so it's very exciting times. And yes, that's part of it.
I think to your point, I think the toolkits, we're seeing that so much on the web now with these widgets and graphics. And I think if you can go beyond just a one-way relationship between the toolkit supplier and the consumer, but in fact open it up laterally so that other people can participate as well in any kind of a tool creation, then I think we'll get this kind of effect that we sort of see in a game like what Matt works on.
Right. And it's physical stuff as well as software, because nowadays you design everything sort of as an information product first. And so it's just really amazing.
I was curious if you had any comments. I looked a little bit at the Linux Foundation report about the contributors to Linux, the kernel, and the dramatic number of commercially employed programmers who are contributing to Linux. And I think that really is a migration away from volunteer effort to largely commercial. What's the implications for the product when that happens? I mean, can you have a split world?
Yeah, I think that's actually good news in the sense that somehow these developers are getting paid now to participate, and that their hobbies are becoming full-time paying jobs. I think two things are going on.
Are they the same developers?
In many cases, at least historically, these guys were volunteers, and they got employed by these companies. I think. So 10 years ago, people would say, well, Linux doesn't scale up, you know, only goes to 4 processors or 8 processors, you know, it doesn't work on supercomputers, and like, which hacker had a supercomputer in their basement that they could get access to, right? So I think, as we think about the types of applications that Linux is now going into, there are certain cases where you do need these heavy physical assets and heavy physical things to work with, and then the companies are providing, you know, are seeing in their best benefit to have these individuals work on these projects, but it doesn't preclude the volunteer participation. In fact, I think it actually helps it along the way, because now they can actually have a conversation across a whole spectrum of use cases, not just the basement hackers, but the very professional developers as well. So I think in the end, it's beneficial. But also, I think I don't know if anybody's done the analysis as to how many of these people are working for user companies versus software publishers, right?
That's the point. Kareem and I always finish each other's sentences. Yeah. So the thing is that you remember that users are also companies. So if Microsoft is making server software, and there's also Apache server software out there, it's not so that it has to be individuals in their basements. Amazon and all these people hire 1 or 2 engineers each. It's just that the innovation effort, although paid, has moved up into the user layer.
Yeah.
See, that's...
And I think most of the analysis of sort of in the academic world, the game theoretic analysis has been sort of a community publisher and a commercial publisher of software, right? And we sort of try to see when does a community fight against a company and what are the dynamics. But what's missing in that analysis, and we hope to fill this up this summer, is that in fact there's a third party, which is a user company participating, a la Google, a la Amazon, a la Orbitz, right? They are not in the business to sell software, they're selling you something else, they're selling you services. But their participation and their release of the of some of this code back to the community completely changes the dynamics.
Yeah, I was interested in the math frame of your example of how many people it needs to be in a community to how many are participating to how many are actually innovating.
Yeah. So in my analysis of Postgres, what we see is that there is still a core group, 10, 12 people that are doing what looks like most of the work. But when you analyze the work and you sort of see, you know, what are they doing, what you see is that they're actually doing work that's what we call sort of dimension of merit improvements, making software harder, faster, better, right? But then the most of the functionally novel things, things that are adding new functionality in software, those come from these peripheral users. And they keep coming in and out. So in a community like Postgres, there were, you know, 12 core members, and then the rest of the 900 folks were all for users. They just do one little thing, small thing, then move on.
Does it change much by the type of software being worked for? Does it change much by the type of class?
Yeah, I haven't done that kind of analysis yet. I think the pattern is fairly robust, and I've shown it to other community leaders and other projects. But we haven't done this was my sort of my slaving over dissertation. I could sort of, you know, read 15,000 emails, manually match source code commits to people to, so until we have a more automated mechanism, this will be the
which you as a user will develop.
All my graduate students might develop.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I found your work really fascinating, and I was just curious about two things. First of all, can you name or give us an example of a company that sort of tried take advantage in a positive way of this new innovative reality going on that, you know, could be looked at perhaps as a model for other companies going forward. And I was wondering also what patterns do you see across nationalities? For example, I know Israel has a large bunch of people code development. And I was wondering just in general, do you see any patterns?
So, I mean, what you're doing is you're saying users are the innovators in the design space, okay? But there's still other things that have to be done, complementary products and so on. So one of the things that manufacturers are doing is saying, how can I link my users via, for example, a toolkit? So if you look in this, for instance, in democratizing innovation, you'll see a firm called Stata. And what Stata does is a statistical software company. What Stata does is says, fine, we know we do not invent the statistical tests. Users invent them. We will watch the user websites, because they have community websites on this thing. And we will pick up the best innovations. Now, Stata has, however, a proprietary core of code that they keep proprietary, and that's how that works. The same thing is going on with Lego. Lego is looking around and saying, my God, we have 50 designers in-house, and there are 20,000 users outside designing code, or in this case, models. Why don't we publish their models? And so what they set up is something called Lego Factory, where you can actually design your own box. You can post this thing for sale on the Lego site. And again, what it's doing is saying there's a distinction between distribution, manufacture, and so on. We can do those things while intelligently yielding innovation to the user. And exciting news, Denmark has now made this sort of national policy. They're trying to push this. They think they cannot win, they feel, on the side of R&D push. You know, countries like the U.S. will outwin them. So what they're saying is maybe we can be very friendly to these sort of internet communities, users, and so on, and produce their stuff ahead of others. So it's, and the UK is coming along in that too.
I'm from Microsoft.
You don't need to apologize.
It's okay. Heal.
Well, I can actually point to an example that's being used at Microsoft. The XNA Creators Club, yeah, where people are allowed to create games for the Xbox, and on the vote of the community, they actually have the opportunity to distribute their games that they produce very high-end markets for the Xbox. So
yep,
it's being successfully used there.
Yep.
And we tend to believe, and I'd like to check this with you, that collective production of content is possible, and users don't seem to mind that you're going to profit from it, as long as they also have a stake in the outcome. As long as they know that they're going to benefit from what's being produced and they have a share in it, they're willing to participate.
Yeah, I think, so if you go back to Eric's example of Stata, Stata makes a statistical software package, right? If you look through the manual, right, so who is producing all these statistics, like Kareem's Kappa or Eric's Eta, would be done by an academic, right? And we care about citations and recognition, right, as creators of these things. And so they're very smart. As you go through the manual, right, when you get to K, right, Kappa by Kareem, right, let's say at the end, this was done by Kareem Makhani, you know, and the reference even the paper where this first came out of, right? So, and close to about 40% of the manual has these citations that sort of come from it. So users there are many heterogeneous motivations to participate. Some of it can be, I want a piece of the action. And depending on the institution you set up, you might have to give a piece of the action. So like a company like Threadless, which does t-shirts,
yeah,
right, they give you money for it.
Yep.
Right? If you have a winning design, they'll give you money for it. In other settings, it's like just a recognition is good enough. Right? And so you have to sort of, I don't think it's free labor in the sense of like, you know, we get all this great free stuff. It's actually a lot of work to make this happen. But then it's the institution that you set up that other people agree to participate with that comes through.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and these are early days as to how this is going to work. You know, companies, somebody asked how often this is, or whether they're successful models. We're citing rare successful models. Most companies are still in the deer in the headlight stage of what, you know. So,
John.
So one of the questions that I throw out for research is, what are the essential preconditions to these things emerging? Because if you look at like Postgres, you've got source forge, you've got the internet, you've got places for the code to go, standard places to discuss it. And the pharma industry is struggling to figure out how to use some of this. But there are all sorts of fundamental infrastructures that don't exist yet that seem to need to exist to enable some of these explosive user-driven innovations to come out.
Yeah.
And so has there been any research on what are the, you know, five infrastructure elements that you need to have to do this?
Yeah. So
you know the answer to that.
Right.
Well, actually, I don't know if you guys are doing research on it yet.
Oh, well, why don't you tell us your answer and then we'll tell you for you, right?
Wait a minute. You're the one who's like, oh, shoot.
Okay, so modularity, you know, heterogeneity of knowledge that people have, and an opportunity to get a benefit from each little increment. So, for example, in one of the issues with respect to pharma is you have to do such a huge thing before you can benefit in some way from it that it hasn't been modularized yet in a decent fashion. So, but it looks like when you do get modularity, when you get, you know, low communication, which everybody now has, when you have good tools, then in fact, and benefit from an increment, then in fact it appears to be everywhere. We did a look in the SIC code with Ethan Mollick just to see how many user communities there were, and just everywhere. You know, I mean, it was very hard to find something. I mean, you know, where there wasn't, you know, turnip washing. I mean, you know, earwig training, you know, I mean, you name it. Yeah.
But also, I mean, I think another component with tools is sort of, can you share and assess knowledge? And what's the basis of sharing and assessing knowledge? So in software, we have the compiler and we have the ability to take anybody else's code, run it on your own machine, understand it, and figure it out. In pharmaceuticals, where you have such wide disciplinary bases, and we don't know what this might do in the human body later on, that those things, until we come up with better simulation models, until we can come up with different communities in pharma that can sort of say, okay, I understand what the physiology guy is saying, and I can, the mouse guy can actually create this in the mouse. Until that happens, I mean, I think we'll sort of see attempts at it, but not the same kind of a rapid speed that we see in code.
Now you want to give your answer, now that we've done all
that?
Okay. So please. Yeah.
You have the statistics as to the profile of the collaborators, in, for instance, in the Linux kernel or in any other open source product, because it seems to me that you're saying that you have 12 collaborators that are full-time, non-paid, and on top of that, you have 900 guys that are being paid by company to contribute to the product.
Yeah.
The question is, if you analyze the profile of these guys and how it has been developing through time, perhaps you can discern that, wow, it is changing so fast that the original model is changed, because perhaps I can, based on your argument, I can assert it doesn't seem to me that collaborative right now. Perhaps it is still collaborative, but the nature of the collaboration there has changed. So, do you have any statistics that you have?
So, I'm raising two different questions. One is, so even the 12 core guys are actually encouraged to participate. So Tom Lane works for Red Hat. He's just being seconded to work on Postgres. Right. Bruce Melvin used to work for this company called SRA, which is a Japanese software integrator. Now he's working for a company called NYDB, which is making a business out of Postgres. So even the core guys have either publishing jobs or user-focused jobs that are one of the guys who works for Afilius, which is a big internet registry. They use Postgres quite a bit, and they find it important for him to be participating in it. Right, so almost to the model of sort of the art, the sort of the artist entertainer kind of model, where you sort of say, we know you're going to do good work, it's going to benefit our company one way or the other, and we're going to let you do, we maybe a lot of independence for you to work on this thing. So in fact, yeah, I don't think it's sort of the volunteer aspect of it is from the point of the project, right? The project isn't paying anybody to participate, right? But the motivations can be pecuniary, i.e. I'm being told by the boss to participate, you know, paying money to participate, or because I need it for my code, or because I'm enjoying what I'm doing, I'm here for learning. And I think that is what is the core that when I've done studies of motivation that sort of stayed around. I think the numbers are probably more increasing towards firms sponsoring people to participate. And that will probably change, I think, the nature of the output we produce in the end. But it doesn't prevent the volunteers who are doing it for whatever reason to also come in.
But in your opinion, doesn't the economic motivation change any aspect of the collaborative environment?
I will test it for us. I don't know. I can't give you an answer. Right? Can you think about what the change might be? So what are you doing?
I know. It seems to me that when this process started off, you had a fully commercial model and a fully open source model where everyone was here going challenge, and nobody was paying that to anyone, at least in the beginning, I suppose. It seems to me that the thing is...
No, I don't think that was true even in the beginning. So maybe Linus Torvalds was being paid, but certainly the folks who were writing the code were working in institutions where the code was being used. And again, it was not a publisher model yet, right. But there was some degree of connection between the user of the code in Linux, right, and the guys who were contributing. Right. So I think there was this view that, oh, look how these guys are just spare time volunteers going away. From the point of the project, yes, spare time volunteers, but from the point of the person, they had real needs for that real code. And they will be subsidized by their institutions to participate.
But the economics of it depend upon it being freely revealed.
Yeah.
They don't depend on how you pay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe it's not a little related. I'm curious if you have thought much about the management ownership structures. I mean, we've got the Linux Foundation, we've got Sun, I mean, Java, sort of commercial entity, we've got a bunch of volunteers who just do projects. Are there other models that I haven't thought about, and are there trade-offs in how it's kind of owned?
Tell me about it. I mean, Harry and I are not doing, I mean, you know,
the world is so full, this is such a new area, the world is so full of low-hanging fruit, you know? I mean, all of us can just have such a ball here, you know, I mean, it's just wonderful. So one of the things that we're looking at now in our current paper is, well, you know, maybe you don't need the core at all. In other words, as we look at the kinds of innovations being done, you know, Kareem mentioned that there are 700 or 900 people in a periphery participating and often not paying attention to the core. Well, if you substitute a toolkit for the core, maybe it truly is totally democratic. You know, so this is another model to add to your piece. You know, it's like, well, this is you know, it's like science and something like that, where it's totally open and nobody's running it, but there's sort of collaborative building, sort of like a coral reef. So the coral reef theory of innovation.
So what you can imagine, I mean, so if you think about Mozilla and Firefox, I mean, there's an explosion of extensions in Firefox, right? And those are almost completely independent of what, as long as the API is published and people know how to write the extensions, people can do whatever they want. And there's no need to interact with the Firefox core developers, right? And so if the more we can create this extension that every product will have an extension layer, and that we can keep shrinking the product over and over and over and over, then we have the problems on that. And institutionally, we are seeing sort of these non-profit foundations, so Mozilla Foundation playing an interesting role with Mozilla Corporation, you know, because there is this concern around impedance mismatch, right? So at least in the world of software, the biggest consumers of software tend to be big institutions, governments, and corporations, and CIO wants to write a check to somebody, right? He wants to build his empire and have a big budget. And open source models don't help them with that, right? I mean, JP might be able to answer that question. But most CIOs want to blame somebody, want this view that, oh, I can blame somebody for the problem, and I'm going to talk to a sales guy, to take me to a nice 2-martini lunch, and do all these things, and what are my employees doing bringing all this code without us paying for it? So I think there might be this impedance mismatch thing, too, and that you might sort of find these sort of pseudo-institutional arrangements where there are these foundations or these corporations that help sort of mass the impedances between what the communities are doing and what the...
Well, it seems like in new democracies, you always, you know, you worry about what's the second president going to be, right? You got to have a succession.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of these systems, I don't think we've had a succession.
Not yet.
And so I guess you're implying that once Corbel finally steps aside, you'll actually unleash a bunch of creativity across the network that he's been, you know...
Again, we have to see. Now, another thing that's happening is that corporations are understanding it. And so one of the things is the network effect. You know, look at eBay or something like that. What you do is you corral people. It's not your content anymore, YouTube. You corral people, but you own the corral. And everybody else sort of can't walk away very easily because they have to walk away en masse to get the same sort of network effect going. So there are ways that even if users are doing innovation, which is what we're talking about, there's all sorts of debates and wars still going on as to who's going to own, in effect, the space. Question.
First question, the comment is that you look in the commercial space, I mean, you talk about the manufacturer as this sort of, we're going to dominate you, we're going to do whatever, but if you look, I fund startups, you look in the startup world, a lot of the problem with this innovation is that the less sexy problems don't get solved, and so manageability and predictability and all of these things that make these innovations more valuable in the long run don't get addressed in the same way commercial entities come in and say, okay, fine, we'll solve those problems.
Yeah.
And so, you know, MySQL doesn't become the cheapest alternative necessarily, even though it's free. So the question is whether you've yet seen this thing called Get Satisfaction, which is, you know, kind of open source customer support thing, and, you know, the guys starting at Facebook said, look, you know, instead of trying to convince people to do a better job of customer support, we're just going to
create ourselves
communities, and
cool,
we're going to open it up, and we're going to encourage you, the company, to come and understand what your customer is saying. And it strikes me as a very much an open forum for consumer innovation, where, you know, consumers say, you know, their poster child example right now is the Timbuktu bag, which, you know, people, the zealots to Timbuktu, go to Get Satisfaction in the Timbuktu community and say, you know, why is it that your zipper compartment in this messenger bag sucks and whatever, and then everybody says, oh yeah,
it should be made out of felt because then it would slip. And, you know, there's this back and forth, and then the company comes in and says, that's an awesome idea, and then incorporate it into the next bag.
Yeah. So, you know, we saw this, you know, this is the history of Usenet, right? Usenet support groups did that a long time ago around all, not just open source products, but Microsoft had this, still has this big MVP community. And within Microsoft, there's been an ongoing debate as to what we do with these people that we don't pay, right? But they're answering our support questions for us, right? And it's been an ongoing, some going to kill them, some going to embrace them, because firms don't know what to do about all these people who are like talking about their products and saying what's wrong with them and suggesting improvements when the marketing group is sort of saying, keep it all hidden and away from
them. Well, that's funny. I was having a conversation with the CMO of HP. He said, I'm trying to embrace blogging. I'm on the board of this part. He said, what do we do with blogging? And what would we blog about? And I said, well, why don't you take your biggest support problems and blog about that? Answer, you know, you get these questions where people say, OpenView sucks because whatever. Yeah. So that's what you blog about. He's like, ooh, that sounds scary.
I bet he didn't do it, right?
One of the things that I've noticed in user communities are different patterns. So I'm curious if you've seen different patterns in the kinds of communities that innovate. To me, it feels like they're often driven by the kind of motivations of the participants in the community, for example, ones that are trying to solve their own problem. And whether or not you've categorized some of those, I'm specifically thinking of like the Firefox plugin example. I participate in electronic hobbyist community, and there's a lot of values in those communities around novelty, originality, and ownership. So people are often, and same with the plugins, people are often doing a lot of the repeat. Like a whole bunch of people will go, oh, well, I want ownership over this, so I'm going to build my own version of it. A lot less like for the example you had, people were sort of working on the same code. It's very much not like open source software. So, and those models I see replicated in different places. So I'm wondering, do you see patterns? Do you categorize those at all?
So Carlos Baldwin has a theory about this. She's our colleague at Harvard with us. And what she sees that when you get this kind of like, you know, there's 115 text editors on SourceForge, like we did Emacs and then we did blah, 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 you know, do we need, and what it is that the design space is being explored, right? So Emacs is down one trajectory, and for some other reason, somebody else wants to do something else, and that the design space is being explored by all these different similar types of the same thing being done. And then there may be, you know, sort of IP reasons for it. So Carlos and our colleague Joachim Henkel are doing this notion of IP modularity, that sometimes you modularize code because of IP constraints around it as well. And so again, we're at the beginning of this thing where what we see is that the design space is being explored out, and because the cost to enter are so low, anybody can start set up their own extension, their own plugin, that we sort of see this flourishment of this design space being explored. And then one will pop either because of path dependence, because it was the first one, it was the best one, and so on, or that over time there's a phase shift between the old one and the new one along the way.
So maybe we just do a quick summary. Can we do that?
How much time do we have?
We have to stop a couple minutes.
Oh, do we? Okay.
Yeah. So quick summary, you know, users are unique in the sense that they don't have to benefit from selling something. As a consequence, they can share freely. The power of this is such that it is going to dominate basically the traditional model of enclosed manufacturing relationship. And what we are all engaged in now is figuring out the new rules, figuring out the new models, and so on and so forth. And this is really enormously exciting because it's an area where really the old way has been evolved over many, many years, and people are just beginning to wrap their heads around the new. All of us are, obviously. And so, I mean, we're lucky to live in this time, I think.
If one was interested in further details or whatever,
what would you suggest? Go to Eric's website.
Well, I have a free book. You can get two for the same price. Just go to my website and you can download it. And I talk a lot about the whole community's activity. Kareem also has a free book on there as well,
yeah,
right?
On open source, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, go to open source on mit.edu. There's a bunch of papers from scholars from around the world.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that?
Opensource.mit.edu.
So thank you very much.